Greetings to everyone this week. It's time for another episode of the podcast. This week's episode does come with a trigger warning, however. My guest, Dana Diaz, is a prime example of resilience, incredible strength, bravery, and ultimately, triumph. Her life is an incredible example of what it looks like to survive despite incredible odds. And this week's episode does include talking about abuse, domestic violence, and what it looks like to live with people who are narcissists. Please take care of your hearts. And based on some conversations I've had with some listeners, I know that some of you have gone through this. I really want you to know before you just jump into this episode what you're going to be hearing. But I do have to tell you, this week's episode is about success. It's about resilience. It's about creating and crafting a life. And really, truly, Dana is the miracle. I know I like the miracle to be somewhat of a surprise, and Dana does tell a story about that. But really, in my mind, Dana's ability to survive and thrive, that's the miracle this week. So now, here's episode 153 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
You know, I realized that I could either be a victim and I can live in it and nobody would question it because, I mean, after everything I'd been through, I think I deserve a few years in bed crying and sleeping and getting over it. But that wasn't who I was. I wanted to take it. And, you know, I always say I'm just taking lemons and making lemonade with a little vodka.
Who are you as a human being? If you had to go to a conference and introduce yourself, or you're entering a room and there are four or five people come up to you and you have to just say, hey, this is who I am. This is how I roll. How do you do that? How do you self-identify? How do you self-describe?
It's funny you bring that up because I love Brené Brown, and I just saw a bit that she did, and I don't even remember what it was on YouTube, TikTok, whatever. But she was basically discussing that, how she has this title, but she's introduced as this, that, and the other thing. But really, this is kind of what she does. And, you know, I thought about it, and people always ask me the same thing. How do you want to be introduced, or who are you? And I'm like, I'm just me. I'm just me. And that's all I can be. I write during the day, and I have a real job that pays for all this publishing that I do, writing books, and, you know, because that's just life. And I'm a mom, and I'm a wife, and I'm a stepmom, although I don't like that step stuff. I love him just the same as I love my son. And, you know, I'm just who I am, and that's all I can be. And I don't think that giving me a title or some prestigious, you know, name makes me any more or any less than anybody else. So we're just going to say, I'm just Dana. And my publisher says that's not an exotic enough name. Like, I can't just say I'm Dana, but it is what it is. I didn't pick my name. That's how I roll. That is who I am.
So you're in Illinois now. Did you grow up in Illinois or?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
You're rolling your eyes.
Yeah, we don't usually talk like politics and money and all that fun stuff, but you know, there's not, yeah, I'd rather be on a tropical island. My mother's family, my mother's Puerto Rican. So, you know, grandma came from Puerto Rico. On my biological father's side, one grandparent came from Germany and one from Italy. So, I mean, Illinois, I'd rather be in Germany, Italy, or Puerto Rico. Let's be real.
I do have to say, I did interview a fascinating woman early on in the podcast named Maria Benedetti, really accomplished human being, journalist,
has been to Puerto Rico and now lives there, but multiple times. And she went down there to really just gather and save for future generations the healers down there, their stories in the small villages of how they treat medical ailments or spiritual ailments. And that's been her life, is in Puerto Rico, saving this knowledge.
And it's amazing. And I'm laughing, and forgive me, but I'm laughing because here in the States, you know, people that have been in my life and have heard my conversations with my grandma and great grandma when, you know, I have a sore throat or when I was pregnant and ill, the concoctions people have called, have accused me of witchery and voodoo. And I'm like, no, this is just a Puerto Rico, like in the islands in the Caribbean, they just, it's a root of this and a baby's toe and the blood of that. I don't know. I don't know what they're talking about, but but it's a very real thing. And they have lived like that for, I mean, forever. That's the culture. And so I laugh at it just because of the reaction I normally get from people when I'm like in a store trying to find the root of this and the hair of that or whatever. But these are all organic, like, you know, food grade things. I'm joking about the baby's toes only because I sometimes mess with people that I have to go find a baby's toe in the middle of the cornfields or something because of the way people look at me. But yes, I mean, grandma and great grandma swore by these things. So it is actually really interesting. None of these things taste good. I can attest to that. And I'm not sure if just they healed me because I didn't want any more of whatever concoction or if it really was effective. But, you know, it is definitely an interesting thing. I do love the islands, though. That's where my heart is. I love Puerto Rico. But I'll go to any island in the Caribbean, honestly.
So our goal, I guess, is to get you so fabulously wealthy or maybe, you know, mid wealthy so that you can move to an island and walk out your front door and there's a beach right there. I think that's.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm a beach girl. And that is my plan. I am remarried since, you know, the book that I have out is about my previous marriage, didn't go so well. But I'm newly married to a wonderful man, but he's 11 years older and he loves being here where we are because this is where his children and grandchildren are. But I keep telling him that theoretically he will, go see Niall before I do. And at that point, it won't matter where we are because I can take him anywhere and tell him we're in Illinois and his kids live down the street. So the plan is Puerto Rico because he loves it there just as much as I do. And, you know, we have military defenses with the U.S. there and life is good on a beach and a pina colada doesn't hurt. So
true story. True right? story about the pina colada.
And that is the birthplace of the pina colada, by the way.
I didn't know that.
Yes, ma'am. You're welcome, by the way.
Tell you, this is so funny. I was in Santa Fe and I went over to a friend's house to house it. And it was a new friend, so I didn't know very much about him. And, you know, he's like, help yourself to the fridge. And he opens the fridge and it is just crammed with condiments. And I said, my God, are you from the Midwest? And he started laughing. He's like, yes. How did you know? And I was like, the condiments. Every Midwesterner's fridge is full of every kind of condiment.
That is actually true. Yeah. Yeah. My husband is the king of condiments. I swear to God, everything you can imagine. But yeah, that's another podcast. We can have like an eating podcast or recipes or something, but
it could be called Let's Talk About Ketchup.
That would be great.
Well, did you grow up in a religious household or what did that look like for you as a kiddo?
So that was really weird because obviously, you know, most Hispanic cultures, I think, are Catholic. So, you know, yeah, I was born and raised Catholic. But the problem with me being born was that I was born to a teenage mother and she didn't want me. In fact, immediately after she birthed me, she had her tubes tied. So she really didn't want children. Plus, she endured a lot of ridicule and shame for being a pregnant unwed teenager, because that wasn't okay back in the 70s. But it was grandma and great grandma that actually decided that I would not be put up for adoption or aborted or any of those things. So they wanted to raise me within the family. And I'm glad they did, because my great grandma is my heart. She's not with us anymore, but in my heart, she's my mother. I lived with her. She was my nurturer and my soother. And it was a wonderful, just all our time together, I'll treasure forever. Grandma decided she would get a job to pay for my expenses. So basically my mother didn't have to bother with me much, which was good and bad, because unfortunately when she did find somebody to marry, she found the king of all narcissists, and everybody decided it would be a good idea for her to take me with her into his home in the suburbs, you know. So I was going from being raised by, you know, Spanish speaking communal people in the city of Chicago, which is a melting pot of its own, to a very Caucasian upper middle class, you know, where mom tried to straighten my hair and don't roll your R's and don't tell anyone we're Puerto Rican. And she's putting me in Gap clothes and, you know, taking off the frilly floral dresses that grandma was putting me in. And, you know, it was hard. So part of that process was I went from, yeah, baptism and going, you know, we still went to Latin midnight mass as Catholics at Christmas time, and, you know, wearing the little gloves and the hats and the dresses and all that, to now we're with this guy who said he was Jewish, but I'd never seen him wear a yarmulke or light a menorah or go to temple at all, ever, to this day. And I'm 48. And so it was like we weren't going to church anymore. And I even was going to a private Catholic school, and he decided he didn't need to pay for another man's child to go to a private Catholic school, because he was calling me dumb and everything else. Yes, he was verbally abusive, and that turned into physical abuse. But it was kind of strange, though, that in the midst of all this, it was obviously a big transition for me, not just being put in this situation with two people who clearly didn't want me to be with them, and also being thrown into a situation where I'm being told it's not okay to be who you are. You have to be somebody else. You have to mix in, try to conform. Don't say this, do that, wear that. In the midst of all this, in second grade, when I'm thrown into public school, I didn't know what to do. And there was a little girl who saw me getting picked on. Kids were picking on how I talked because I was rolling my R's, and, you know, that grandma rolled her R's when she talked. And, you know, I was trying not to speak Spanish and I was trying to fit in, but I was different. And this little girl, I'll never forget her, Kelly McDonald, in second grade. She, after I got beat up on the playground, because it was okay to do that too then, you know, back in the early 80s, you know, teachers just let kids duke it out. She kind of helped me clean up and wash my hands and wipe the dirt off me. And then the next day she brought in a little piece of paper and kind of passed it to me. I thought she was passing me a note in class, and I opened it up, and it was a gold chain with a Virgin Mary on it. And I'm like, I can't take this from you. This is expensive. And she said, no, you need it more than I do. You need the Holy Mother. And I just thought it was the sweetest thing. I know, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, because I thought, second grade, I mean, what are we, 6 years old? And that's such, I mean, the compassion that's shown in that gesture, it sat with me forever. And we were lifelong friends, because let's be real. In my situation, I was going through a lot, obviously, but it's very hard developmentally when you're a child and your basic needs were met and now they're not. My mother didn't come in and rock me if I needed soothing. She didn't want to hear anything I had to say. And, you know, I was becoming more withdrawn, and I wasn't supposed to say this and do that and don't tell people this and that. So I just didn't talk to anybody at all. I probably came off weird and shy, and, you know, but it's not who I was either. because around the family, oh my goodness gracious, I was loud and I was rambunctious and tenacious. And that's what happened with my stepfather, is that, you know, every time something would happen, he would say something terrible to me. I would stand up for myself, because I would go to my mother and she would just say, oh, that's how he is. And she just didn't see reason. She even accused me of lying a few times that I was trying to get attention. So I had to stand up for myself and fend for myself, you know, even as a little girl. But that just meant physical consequences that weren't too pleasant. But unfortunately, it's the words that stayed with me my whole life.
I am so sorry to hear that. And I can't even imagine, you know, a lot of times I'm talking to guests and they reference things that happened in their childhood. And, you know, there's a difference between, you know, someone, let's talk about adults, you know, adults saying something and not thinking that, you know, like not really understanding the level of how it's going to affect the child, the capacity to how it's going to affect a child. But it sounded like, you know, your mom was in denial. And it sounds like your stepfather absolutely knew what he was doing and didn't care.
Oh, absolutely. That's all narcissists, though. You know, and I want to say, when I speak of narcissists, because this is my unfortunate area of expertise, involuntarily, you know, it's a term that's used so loosely. I want to be clear, I'm talking about what we call malignant narcissists, and these are the narcissists that are causing you intentional harm so that they could feel that ego boost, you know, through that power and that domination and that control. So these malignant narcissists, they know exactly what they're doing, and they are doing it intentionally. And, you know, people can read and hear about it, but to say they have no empathy whatsoever, they have no remorse, they actually feel justified in what they are doing. But it's just a perfect example of how low they will go. Because yes, I mean, imagine saying, let's put it this way, I'll give you a few more examples. I was maybe what, 6-7 years old, making toast for breakfast. And he was making snide remarks about the toast. What are you eating? Toast? You know, like I'm thinking, what's it to you? Well, why are you making it that way? Because I put butter on it and I sprinkled sugar and cinnamon because it tastes a lot better that way. Well, he didn't like that. Why are you doing it like that? I said, well, I don't know. It's kind of like French toast. That's not how you make French toast. It was this cutting over critical stuff. But the worst part was, that's going to make you fat. You're going to look like a middle-aged woman. I'm 6 years old having a piece of toast. But this was when mom would make spaghetti for dinner, the spaghetti is going to make you fat. So now I've got an eating disorder on top of feeling deficient. And I mean, obviously I had no self-esteem and I feel hypervigilant all the time because I got to gauge the mood in the room and notice everybody's expressions. And, you know, are there any physical threats? You know, like I can't even think straight because I'm so worried just about my general safety and the anxiety that comes with that. Now I got to worry about how I look because I, you know, I'm 7, 8, 9 years old now. I don't want to look like a middle-aged woman. Oh my God, that must be a bad thing. I must be getting fat. I better not eat noodles. I better start counting my calories, you know, and then I'm overcompensating, working out, going for runs in 6th and 7th grade because, oh my gosh, I had an extra serving of pasta at dinner. I better go run it off right now so I don't get fat. It's, you know, to call it abuse is light, but, you know, sadly the verbal abuse is what was worse because yeah, I was strangled. I was straddled and beaten and slapped and gripped and, But all those wounds healed, the scratches healed, the bruises went away, and I'm not minimizing by any means. I know some people have endured much worse physical abuse, but that stuff got better. My body doesn't feel that anymore, but my heart feels every bit of those words. They were like just daggers to my soul, and they sometimes play on repeat with me as an adult. So that was the worst part of it. And it was hard to have a mother that just turned her head. And, you know, I always say, now looking back, you know, since I've been healing and all this stuff, I realized she enabled, excused, and tolerated. And she had wanted to get out of the city. She had wanted to get out of that life. I think she had always had this idea that, you know, coming from this, you know, Hispanic culture and, you know, maybe it wasn't fancy enough for her. She wanted a house and she wanted a car and all these things. And, you know, I guess she got that. And I don't judge, but it's sad to me that she sacrificed her only daughter, you know, in order to achieve that, and then allowed this man to do to her, you know, almost what her father had done. You know, we talk about these transgenerational cycles, and yeah, my mother was abused. Her father was an alcoholic, put a gun to her head. I've heard so many stories. And even my stepfather, his parents actually abandoned him and his siblings when he was just a baby. Like literally abandoned them. They were discovered when they were begging for food on the streets, and they were given, as wards of the state, separated into foster homes. And as adults, they came back together. Tragic stories. And my heart goes out to both of them. But my problem is, you know, that when people like that have been through stuff, wouldn't that make you more conscientious of a child that's in your care so that you would choose otherwise? Because honestly, by the time I was 12 years old, I thought there's no way I'm having a baby, because I was worried about that cliche that you turn into one of your parents. And I was like, there's no way I'm doing that to another human being. And I didn't trust myself not to. But then I wanted a baby because everybody else was having one. We were all getting married. We were all going to baby showers. Everybody's having babies. And well, then I wanted one too. And I was still starving for love though. And that was my problem. I didn't get it in my childhood. I married a man that honestly, the second I met him, he reminded me of my stepfather. Wasn't good. He was the only game in town though, at least the only one interested in me. So I gave it a shot because those little crumbs of affection and attention that he gave me were enough. And then I married him thinking it'll get better, things will change, and it didn't. So I thought if I had a baby, this will be the love of my life. I'll love this thing more than any mother ever loved their child after everything I've been through, and everything's going to be okay. And I did. I loved, and I still, he's going to be 21 in a few months. And my son has been I always say the sun rises and sets around my son. I love that. Well, he's always going to be my baby, but it's such a weird thing to me that now, having been through the process of having a child and raising a child and even raising a child in another abusive home, I protected him. I sheltered him and shielded him, sometimes with my body, but other times with not knowing, because he doesn't even know the half of, you know, what happened to me in that home. But he's really good. And I think it's because he knew he had safety and security with me. I was the stable thing in his life. I was consistently there, unwavering, unconditional love. And he can, to this day, he can tell me anything and everything, and I will not flinch. I will not nag. I will not judge. I just love him and I will mother him. We can get through anything together. I just wish that my own mother could have thought that about me. But I have found my little piece of wisdom in all this in my life is that, you know, my mother and stepfather, my ex-husband, all these people had some sort of trauma in their life, but they weren't dealing with it. They didn't want to deal with it. They didn't want to acknowledge it or face it. They wanted to pretend and put on the happy show and like everything's fine. But what they did was they burdened me with it. I don't know why. Maybe I am much stronger than I think I am, that everybody thought I could carry their extra weight. But it wasn't until I realized that I didn't have to, that I finally was able to release it. And just, I think that's why I am so protective now of just being me, because my life was dictated to me from the time I was a little girl with my mother and stepfather. This is what I had to do. This is what I had to be. And this is what was expected. And then I'm in a marriage with another abusive narcissist that had all these rules. Most were unspoken, but I actually do have sheets of paper where he wrote down how to be a good wife. And I sadly was checking them off like a list of chores because I just wanted this man to love me. But now that I'm free of all their unhealed trauma and realizing that I'm not accountable to handle that for them, believe me, I've got enough of my own that I've had to deal with. It has been like, I literally feel lighter. And the most prominent thing that I've learned is because I had gotten sick at the end of my first marriage. I'd gotten very, very ill, dropped down to 93 pounds. I mean, I was skeletal. I couldn't even tear toll. I couldn't breathe. It was awful. But after a year of all kinds of tests and doctors, it was actually Mayo Clinic that did a cortisol test. Cortisol is a stress hormone. And they thought they compromised the labs because they've never seen it that high. So they did the test again. And it turned out that my levels were actually that high. They were over four times higher than they should be at the highest. And it had been consistently, they said basically four decades of living in fight or flight had caused so much cortisol to run through my body. Blood cells thought it had to eradicate like a cancer or a virus. And so they killed themselves off, caused all this havoc in my body. And I also developed rare lung disease that the doctor says is like having COPD and fibromyalgia all at once. But the beauty in all this is that once my mother and stepfather were not in my life, and once my ex-husband was not in my life, within months, and I literally mean just a few months, I gained my weight back. I don't have symptoms anymore. I don't need the backpack oxygen machine that I had to have pretty much daily to breathe and keep my oxygen levels above 83%. 93% was COVID, by the way. Mine were always as low as like 83%. I could not breathe. And that was all because of stress of living in those situations. So I'm glad in a way that I had to experience all that, because I think it's important for people to understand that stress really can kill you. But to also, you know, I want to be that example to people of that idea that life is too short, and it's too short to be a worker ant and just go through the motions every day. It's too short to live the life somebody else wants you to live. I decided at the end of my first marriage, you know, that it was time for me. I was scared to start over at 45 years old. You know, I just thought I'd go be alone the rest of my life. And, you know, hopefully my son wouldn't go too far and I could just cling to him. And I mean, the last thing he needed was a codependent mother. But, you know, I just asked myself a simple question one night. And all I asked myself was, what do I want? What's going to make me happy? And I knew right away what those things were, just a few things. I didn't ask for much after the life I lived. I wanted love. I wanted to be in a marriage. I very much wanted to have that best friend who I went home to every night and just did life with. But I wanted to be with somebody who, well, you know, didn't want to kill me and actually liked me, because, you know, I'm not speaking, you know, humorously, that these were things, unfortunately, that were in my first marriage. I wanted to travel, but my ex didn't want us to travel. In fact, he didn't even like me going to the store. I could go to work and come home. I was basically on a retractable leash because he didn't want me to have any friends, any family, any outside influence. I didn't even have a smartphone until after he moved out of the house. He didn't like me reading on the internet. It was ridiculous. And I wanted to write because I got a degree in journalism in college. I just never got to use it because my ex moved us 90 miles outside of the city and he didn't want me to pursue any kind of career. I did work in real estate. And as I was getting to a very high level of success in property management, he just found ways to manipulate our life in a way that I shouldn't work. And that I left that career because God forbid I have joy or success or achievement or financial freedom to be able to leave him. You know, these are all very typical narcissist things. So I just wanted a few things in life. That's all I wanted. So it's been 3 years and 3 months since my divorce as of today. And in that very short time in which I am healing from domestic violence and a lifetime of trauma and triggers and PTSD, and my nervous system is just off the charts. In the midst of all that, I published a book. And I have two more books coming out, and they are to help other victims of abuse relate and connect and understand and see their situations and the people they're with for what they are. I have been on over 100 podcasts, including yours, because people are being really receptive to this. And it's very unfortunate that victims of abuse are just afraid to share their stories. They're so afraid of exposing their abusers. And so I'm just kind of taking one for the team and saying what needs to be said because people need to know what's going on. Yes, I was going to my son's T-ball games with cupcakes and a smile, but I was dying inside. I was dying for somebody to see what was going on because even my ex, you know, like Ted Bundy, the serial killer, they're handsome and charming, and nobody has any idea. I've also been traveling. I am remarried to a longtime friend, and I've known his family 18 years. Otherwise, there's probably no way I could have dated and gotten married in that short of time. But he has been, it has been amazing because I think to some extent, as much as I hate people calling themselves broken and damaged, to some extent, I think I felt that I was inept at relationships and that it probably wouldn't be a good idea for me to get involved with anybody until, you know, whatever time it was that it took to heal from all the other stuff. But I found that it was actually more effective to be in a relationship with somebody where I was triggered and I was kind of being forced to feel things and have to deal with things because I think too many times people hide and they isolate because they don't want to get triggered and they're scared. And what if it doesn't work out and all these things? And I was there too. But the problem is, yeah, I had all the sheets and the YouTubes and the therapy stuff saying, you know, if you're not to self-regulate, follow these steps. Well, you know, you can have the toolbox, but if you don't have a need for the tools, you know, so you have to get triggered. You have to go through the process of actually practicing the things that you're being told in therapy and the things that you're reading about. And eventually it gets easier. And I think that that's what's helped me along because now things that might have put me in fetal position crying in a corner 2 years ago, I'm just like, might bother me for like 5 minutes, maybe 10, maybe a day, depending how bad it is. But I'm not worried about it because, you know, I know who I am now. And I know that, you know, I know my worth and I know what I deserve. And I have somebody that has given me a safe space to be and feel and do and whatever it is. And let me tell you, all those trips I wanted to take, we went on 9 trips all over the world our first year together. We went on 5 the second year, and I just stopped counting. We just, every time we come home, we plan the next trip, and it's been amazing. So I don't want anyone to think that if they're in a bad situation, no matter how bad it is, your life is not over. It's not over. There is so much more. You just have to be the one to make the choice. And that's the thing about it. You have to decide, and you can decide, because all of those years, 25 years I was with my ex, I thought he was the one holding me there. I thought he had that collar around my neck and holding the leash. Guess what? The night that I decided I was 100% done with this man, guess what I did? I unclicked that collar or that leash off the collar. I was free. I freed myself. And I know other people can do it. It's going to be harder for some than others, but it's absolutely possible.
Thank you so much for just telling all of that. But I think I really appreciate your connecting what happened in your childhood with your first husband, like choice of spouse, choice of relationship, choice of life that you were, you know, and also like the hope that you had, because you had hope that things would be different. And I'm sure you know, even through maybe your first year of marriage, you thought, oh, you know, things can change. Things can absolutely change. And you and I, in our messaging back and forth to each other, you told me about your book, of course, and you also outlined a few things that happened, because, you know, the main gist of the podcast is miracles and magic. And you told me a few things that happened that kind of, I don't know, either stimulated or made you think about things differently, stimulated you to start thinking about leaving the relationship. Because I think when any human is in that kind of situation, I mean, it's almost like your stepfather groomed you to kind of accept this way of life. And so then you get into this marriage where he's grooming you with your rules, the lists, things you can do, where you can go, what you can do. And that kind of like prison, you say it's self-imposed, and it is, but it can be terrifying to step out of line with that kind of person. So I would love for you to share for the listeners some maybe miraculous or things that you felt that were potent enough that it changed your mindset to galvanize you to leave or get out of that relationship.
I think it was just that. You know, I always tell people always ask about red flags, and I think it's about listening to your gut, you know, and following your moral compass, because, you know, I knew, just like in my childhood, I knew it didn't feel right. I was fully aware that what was going on wasn't how it should be. But I did feel stuck. I did feel like there was no way out. And I did have that fear. And I think fear kept me in more than anything else. There was just so much going on. What really did it, though, was just coming to the point of my life. You know, I think that when your life, you know, your health is deteriorating that much, that you're really looking at, oh my gosh, like I'm too young to die and I'm too young to, I think that the miracle in itself was me getting sick. I think people tend to look at, you know, misfortune in life and unlucky things, even the abuse I suffered, you know, like, oh, it's such a terrible, terrible thing. But it depends who you are and how you look at it. It's all in your mindset. Because, yeah, getting sick was the deal breaker for me. That was the point where I realized that this wasn't the life, that this life had been dictated to me, and this wasn't what was resonating with my soul. I realized very, very quickly after my ex moved out that, you know, my happiness didn't have to come from any person or any outward source. It had to come from within me, but it was in the simple things in life. You know, all the things that fill your soul, whether it's a favorite song, a favorite color, you know, some of us like sparkly nails or whatever it is, you know, those were the things that I still to this day say, you got to fill your happy jar. You got to put those things in your heart, because if you don't, or you let somebody prevent you from doing those things, then you're not living authentically and you're not living to your true purpose. But one of the most miraculous things, I think, was coming to that point where, you know, I realized that I could either be a victim and I can live in it and nobody would question it. Because, I mean, after everything I'd been through, I think I deserve a few years in bed crying and sleeping and getting over it. But that wasn't who I was. I wanted to take it. And, you know, I always say I'm just taking lemons and making lemonade with a little vodka, you know, because it was rough. It was bad. But how much better is life now? And how much more do I appreciate the little things in life now? You know, does my husband need to buy me flowers or take me out and to fancy dinners or buy me extravagant things? No, you know, he just loves me. And that's all it is just being kind. And, you know, sort of like that little girl in second grade. I mean, there are people come to you. Those are your blessings. Even my husband now, I'd known his family 18 years. Yet I was at a gas station pumping gas and he peeked around from behind the pump and he was there and he had seen me, you know, and seen me in a way that other people didn't, you know. It's still prevalent to this day because, like, I noticed my ex would always call me beautiful or there was always some reference to my appearance, but the other nasty things he would say to me weren't compliments. And that was the only nice thing he ever said. My husband now rarely, if ever, says, "You look nice" or "You look beautiful." He comes home and kisses me and says, "How's my little writer today?" Or he says, you know, when he leaves in the morning, he gives me a kiss and says, "Okay, go save another woman today. Go empower the world." And that speaks to me, my purpose, my character, my mission. It's a whole other level of somebody understanding who you are and seeing how, you know, just your worth. And, you know, he has this joke, though, once in a while, he gets a little, forgive me, he'll say, "You're shining brighter than a diamond in a donkey's ass." And, you know, it's his funny way. But I love it. Because I don't need to be told I'm beautiful, not because I think I am or anything, but the outside, you know, we all like to look nice and all that, but that fades. I want the kind of depth in a relationship, whether it's a friendship or a family relationship, and hopefully, obviously, with my husband, you know, where it's about who we are deep inside. Because that's what we're bringing into this world. And I think that that's what the world fails to see from the outside. There's a lot of judgment and criticism, just like my stepfather in my childhood. But I've been fortunate enough that I am not taking what I went through for granted, and that I am taking it and trying to make good in it. So in that way, that's been a blessing.
I do have to say that I think you're, you know, a lot of people who tell stories on this podcast, the miracles are always in the past, but I think you are a present miracle. You're like a walking miracle right now. And I so appreciate your husband saying, you know, go save another woman today, because you're actively out there spreading knowledge. I think one of the most powerful things about your story is in some therapies, they have this, this idea or this concept where you go back in time and you have a conversation with your younger self. So it's almost like in your mind's eye, you meet like for you, it would be you in second grade, and you start a dialogue with that second grader, and you talk, you know, you apologize, or you just start talking. And it's almost like you can self-soothe in that way and tell that little second grader, everything's going to be okay. Because when you're in second grade, you don't know that everything's going to be okay. You can't see to where you're 45 or 48. And I think that work is so powerful because, you know, that little second grader had no idea that she would become this force of nature, this fierce advocate, this really potent power out in the world, helping so many other people. And just the fact that you had the strength and resilience to survive till now after everything that you've gone through is a miracle in itself, because the world needs you. And the world needs your story.
I appreciate that, because I truly believe, and I know, you know, I don't impose religion or, you know, ideas of a higher being on anybody, but that is something that I truly, in the depth of my soul, feel is that, you know, as much as I was told I wasn't meant to be here and that I shouldn't be here, I'm realizing, oh no, I was very much intended to be here. I was intended to go through what I went through. I was given the gifts of communication. All of these things aligned. It is not an accident that I went to college, even though I wanted to go to beauty school. I was forced to go to college and I ended up in public speaking and journalism classes. That is not an accident. None of it is. And I feel very strongly that that has given me a purpose. And even for the people who boohoo on that, I say, who cares? Because it makes me feel better. And it gives me the ability to put my foot one in front of the other every day after so many years of living in depression and misery. And literally my physical body was dying inside. Now I am standing up strong. And even with my, you know, medical issues still present, but definitely, you know, subdued for the moment, I am amazed and humbled that anybody has any interest in what I have to say. But I love that every single day I get messages from people saying, I got strength from reading your book. I heard you on this podcast and I had the strength to end that relationship. My kids and I are getting out probably next week. I can't do it today, but we're planning. I'm making this happen. And that just makes me so happy because I'm not trying to wreck homes or wreck families or lives. I just want people to realize their worth and to realize that they were not meant to suffer and they're not meant for that life. And they don't have to stay in that life because you can be, I am literally living proof that no matter what it is, you can be okay because I'm better than okay now.
Curious. Do you know about the hero's journey?
I do not.
Okay. It's actually fascinating. I think you might be very intrigued by it, but the hero's journey was created by Joseph Campbell. And basically, you know, he did years and years, decades of study of myths and fables and stories from all over the world. And every single story follows a certain pattern, no matter how old it is, you know, ancient, thousands of years old, or if it's told today. And basically the hero gets a call to adventure. And they don't know what that means, what that looks like, but it's like, oh, here's this call to adventure. You know, what does this mean? Like, and it's like scary. It's uncertain. You're like, do I want to leave my regular life for this call to adventure? But it's also very concrete. It's almost like, you know, there's a door that appears in front of you and you open it and you step through over the threshold. And then over the course of the journey, you have helpers, so people that come to you in the form of aid, you know, like in Cinderella, the mice who make her ball gown. You have people, ogres, monsters who are trying to tear you down, like Cinderella's stepsisters, people who are fighting in every single story. So you have helpmates and then you have people. You go on the journey. You go on the adventure. You don't know what the end looks like. But at the end, if you have committed to it and you're successful, integrity, authenticity, whatever that looks like, you get a boon, you get a treasure. But the most fascinating part of the hero's journey, because they do suck, because there's supposed to be trials and tribulations during the hero's journey. The most interesting thing about the hero's journey is at the end, for it to resolve to completion, is you take that treasure, that thing you've learned, literal treasure, whatever it is, and you tell the community. Whether it's, so you either educate the community, if it's something you've learned, you share your story about what transpired, how you evolved, how they could evolve, what treasure can they take from it, or you share your gold that you've gotten. It's basically you share your goal with the community, and your life has literally been the hero's journey.
I appreciate that. That's a compliment, but I love how, and I can relate, and I love how you mentioned Cinderella with the mice, because I have used that reference a few times, but I have definitely felt that along the way, because even though, you know, my mother decided we weren't going to church anymore, and, you know, that there were, I can't tell you how many people through my life, just random people, and they were never in my life very long, but just kind of like, I felt like I was being herded back on the path I was supposed to be on. That when I was losing my way or wandering off over here, because I'm curious and I'm human and making mistakes, there was always that nudge back. And again, I whatever you believe, but in my heart, I knew these were people that were sent to make sure that I stayed on that path, you know, and I'm thinking of a couple of them now, and a lot of them were faithful people. But it wasn't so much following the paths, you know, with the church or anything. They were just, they just happened to be faithful people who were just kind and knew how I should be progressing in life and kept me going in that way. And even in the midst of my abusive marriage, I was going to church, and I'll never forget. I mean, in my lowest point, I mean, I was thinking this was it, and I'm just going to die one day, and that was it, and what an awful life I had lived. And as everybody's, we have a big church, so communion takes forever. But as everybody was taking communion, I sit in the front so I could get it first. I'm sitting on my knees or kneeling, and the elderly lady that always sat in the pew behind me, she just came in and she squeezed my shoulder from behind as she passed. And, you know, it's just those little things of, you know, there's nothing you could have said to me, nothing anybody could have necessarily done, because I had to do it myself. But that little squeeze of my shoulder, that gave me that courage to get through that day. You know, somebody giving me a book to read because, you know, you got a degree in journalism, you want to, you know, fill your mind, like, or you might find this story interesting. Maybe I could relate to it, or maybe it was even just to remind myself of grammar and spelling. I don't know, but there were so many little things that happened to get me to where I am. And so I don't take that lightly. And I feel like we live in a world where, you know, I always say there's givers and takers. And my God, there are so many takers, and even people in my life that I thought were my people, the inner circle that I held very dear and very close and was very discriminate about. It's amazing when I really needed them, you know, when all this was happening in my life at the end of my marriage and I'm sick and there's domestic violence and things going on. It's amazing when you can't do for somebody, how quickly they drop you. And you thought, you know, you were much closer than what you were. But, you know, that's a blessing too, because I didn't need to be distracted and putting energy into relationships with people that just wanted from me, because I had had enough taken from me. And it was time for me to stand up and set boundaries and say, okay, no more. This is how it's going to be. Here I am, I'm back. And it's, you know, there's pain in growing, there's pain in healing. There's definitely pain even in succeeding and living authentically and living, you know, not everybody's going to like it. But that's why I go back to when you introduced me and said, who am I? I'm just me, and you're just you, and we're all just who we are, and that's okay. that's okay. And we should all love that. And we're not all going to get along and we're not all going to agree. But if we can give each other the space and primarily the respect and the kindness, I mean, let's solve world peace right now. Let's be real. You know, I always go back to that flower analogy that, you know, you plant a seed in fertile soil and you water it and you provide it sunshine, it's going to grow and the colors and it blooms. And that's where I'm at right now. The first 45 years of my life, I was a seed in dry clay-like soil with no sunshine, no water. I was getting nothing to nourish me. And, you know, it speaks to who we choose to be around us, because, you know, when you're constantly hearing that negativity, I mean, I think I even said it in my book that I didn't even like who my ex-husband had turned me into, because around that, you know, my son always called his dad a negative Nelly, but it was just the same thing like my childhood, my abusive stepfather. It was just always what wasn't, what couldn't, you'll never, you know, all this narrative of not, never, 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 can't, too much, too little, nothing's ever enough. Now I'm around people who actually have raised the bar. Like, I always joke around that literally I think the old ladies at church, altar and rosary society, think I'm a much better person than what I really am. But by gosh, I try really hard to be when I'm around them or when I'm in the community. But that's great. I need that. We all need that. You know, my husband, you know, there are times when I'll say something a little snarky because somebody made me mad, and he'll be like, that's not who you are. He reminds me to be better. He reminds me that that's not who I want to be. And so we all need that in our life. We need the people who are going to make us flourish and not diminish us or keep us down or prevent us. So, you know, that's something to be aware of in your life. And it's just unfortunate that sometimes those people, the right people, may not be your parents or your siblings or your family or, you know, unfortunately, your current spouse.
Yeah, I think it's so important to have people who want to see and encourage us to see our capacity for beauty, the beauty we can bring into the world. We need people like that in our lives that believe.
Exactly. And it's all about perspective, because, you know, it's not just our perspective, but people's perspective of us. Let's be real. We're women. We can get moody. We have times, you know, and I remember my ex just always like the things he would call me, his language was so vulgar. I was always embarrassed if somebody overheard, you know, he never even called me by my name. There were certain things he regularly called me that were disgusting, but, you know, that I responded to like they were my name. But it's funny because now, like, one of my best friends, you know, he calls me almost every day. And, you know, if I'm in a mood or something, he'll be like, "Ooh, you're feisty today. You're a little spicy Latina today." And I love that because he's not saying you're a B, you know, the B word or whatever, or, you know, making me feel bad for my mood. He brings me out of it. He gets me out of it. Or he just looks at it like that, you know, yes, I am feisty today. We'll call it that.
I just love this song. It's so good for my heart. So I'm actually going to let the entire song play, and you can just sit back after I finished my outro, close your eyes, and enjoy its beauty.
I need to thank Dana for being so brave and for sharing her incredibly potent story with me. If you want to check out more of what Dana's about, there will be a link to her website in the episode show notes. And then there will be a link to her book, Gasping for Air, on the treasures page of the website. I encourage each and every one of you to check both out and really, really do a deeper dive into what an incredible human being Dana is. I'm so very grateful that Dana took the time to have this conversation. And I just love meeting human beings who are defying the odds and changing this world into a more beautiful place. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode: Koala Vert, Frank Schroeder, John Bartman, Sasha End, Edie Key 20, and Mikhail Moiskovich. For complete attribution, please see the episode show notes. All that good stuff will be just down below. And I have to tell you guys, I got 6 new ratings this week. Thank you so much, dear listeners. I'm so very grateful to those of you who take the time to give me a rating or write a little review. It just helps so very much. And when I looked at Apple and I saw I got 6 more ratings, my jaw just dropped. I was kind of astonished. So thank you so much for taking the time. It means so very much. And now I'm going to say what I usually do, which is thank you for listening. And here's my one request: be like Dana. Be a survivor. This world is tough, and Lord knows some days I kind of just don't want to crawl out of bed. But know that every day that you, dear babies, you have the strength and you have the wisdom, you have the temerity to say, no, I don't deserve this, or no, I am stronger than this. And survive like Dana, thrive like Dana, create and craft a life worth living. And that's exactly what Dana's did. So be like Dana. Survive and thrive.